I think that maybe, unless you read the byline for today's topic that was printed in the newsletter or reproduced from the website, your expectations about what we're here to talk about today might go unfulfilled. Our place in modernity, you might say. How very forward-thinking, how optimistic, how very Unitarian. You probably assume that because it's college students who are addressing you, that we are here to offer our vision of the bright, shining future ahead of us, and how we as young adult Unitarian Universalists hope and plan to move this faith forward through the coming century. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I will do no such thing, or at least not in the way you're perhaps thinking. At best, I am ambivalent about modernity, and at worst, I despise and loathe it. The corporate media, the corporate churches, and all of their outlets and adherents proclaim that we live in the greatest country in the world, at the greatest time in history, with the greatest degree of personal freedom and the greatest rate of technological advancement. What I would like to do today is question the usefulness or justice of these categories as indicators of our quality of life. Question what exactly it is that we as religious people value in life, and perhaps in my own wide-eyed, unseasoned way, point to a few changes we can make to make our lives more worthy of our living. I like to believe that the business of this faith is in subtleties, and as such, I would like to be very clear and explicit about my terms. Modernity, as I refer to it, does not signify, in its positive sense, the HGTV kitchen of the future, nor the ever-strengthening wave of global consciousness and connectedness, nor does it refer to, in the negative, the contrarian, youthful rejection of cherished customs and beliefs. In a historical sense, the modern era is most often dated to 1789, the year of the French Revolution. The revolution was, for an exhaustive list of reasons you can learn about in any history class at the College of William and Mary, a watershed event in social and political history. Other historians point, perhaps quite rightly, not to specific years or events, but rather to unfolding complex processes, such as industrialization, the enclosure of common agricultural land and alienation from it, and urbanization. They are self-consciously white, Eurocentric markers, but the ideas which they germinated took root across the world. Modern is synonymous with change, renewal, and in some sense, optimism and hope. It is a clear break with what came before, a promise not to repeat the patterns of domination and control of the past. For 18th and 19th century Europeans, this meant the nail in the coffin of feudalistic social and political arrangements. For 20th century Africans, it meant national liberation and a new and profound sense of identity and pride of place in the world. For peoples across the globe, the modern meant the blessing of a break, a resurrection of the good which cannot die. It meant personal autonomy, social freedom, political liberty, change, progress, the cult of the new, the forward march, the obtainably utopian. As I understand it, however, far from the siren call of the promises, of modernity's promises, has been its reality. It is dislocation. It is loss, upheaval, discontinuity, and really most poignantly, a profound and penetrating sense of loss. Loss of identity, loss of place in the world, loss of faith, and loss of hope. Industrialization and social revolution mark a change of pace and tactics, but not priorities. As replacements for the visible signs of domination, colonialism, serfdom, and caste-based obedience, we were handed the International Monetary Fund, wage slavery, and economic necessity. If God is a comedian, her sense of humor is tragically ironic. Where is the break? Where is the change? In a world run by the dictates, where is national liberation in the world run by the dictates of capital? Where is autonomy in the reconstitution of serfdom and slavery and sweatshops, maquiladoras, and an artificially depressed minimum wage? Spiritually, modernity warps faith in that it unbalances an equation between the two. As modernity sends our lives spiraling out of control, religion becomes less and less fluid, and more regimented and dogmatic. Essentially, as we lose control over the forces which shape our lives, and as hierarchical patterns reinsinuate themselves into our lives, religion becomes nothing more than a coping mechanism, a 12-step program, arose from the beginning for dealing with the unbearable brokenness of our world. The tragedy of modernity's false resurrection confronts us on three accounts. It is an attack upon our sense of time, an attack upon our sense of identity, an attack upon our sense of justice. In her book, The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, economist Juliet Shore explains the attack on our sense of time in this way. It is often said that an economist is a person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. On the question of time, we may have all become economists. We are keenly aware of the price of time, the extra income earned with a second job, the wage and a half for an hour of overtime. In the process, we may have forgotten the real worth of time. The origins of modern time consciousness lie in the development of a capitalist economy. Pre-capitalist Europe was largely timeless, or as historian Jacques Lejoffe says, free of haste, careless of exactitude. As capitalism raised the price of time, people began to think of time as a scarce resource. Indeed, the ideology of the emerging market economy was filled with metaphors of time, saving time, using time wisely, admonitions against passing time. The work ethic itself was in some sense a time ethic. When Benjamin Franklin preached that time is money, he meant that time should be used productively. Eventually, capitalism did more than make time valuable. Time and money began to substitute for each other. Franklin's aphorism took on a new meaning, not only as prescription, but as an actual description. Money buys time, and time buys money. Time itself has become a commodity. What Shore goes on to explain, in her own way, is that as time has become a force in the market, its value can only be calculated in ways that the market understands. For example, in women's history, one of the first things that you learn is the myth of women's entry into the workforce. Women have always worked. Rather, the work relegated to them inside the home has no immediate apparent cash value. Housework is indispensable work. It undergirds our social and economic system. But because it is performed by women, we choose not to value it. The market only understands uses of time which have an immediately redeemable cash value, and the devotion of time to housework, painting, journaling, sculpting, playing with our children, gardening, and even worshiping do not. Yet we know, however, that these things are the foundation of our lives. The irony of modernity is again in the lack of positive change, and even the deterioration of our conditions. Medieval serfs had poor nutrition. They were bound to the land and to the law of their masters, but they worked about only half as many days a year as we do now. We cope in a number of ways. We overschedule, obsessively prioritize. The commodification of time is a distortion of its value, and the market will never value an hour at earnest prayer the same as an hour in the sweatshop. The second way in which modernity disappoints and insults us is in its attack on our identity. In his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Chris Hedges, a career war photographer, explains the effect of that ever-present factor of human life, one which has continued and become more vicious despite the supposed humanity of our era. States at war silence their own authentic and humane culture. When this destruction is well advanced, they find the lack of critical and moral restraint useful in the campaign to exterminate the culture of their opponents. By destroying authentic culture, that which allows us to question and examine ourselves and our society, the state erodes the moral fabric. It is replaced with a warped version of reality. The enemy is dehumanized, the universe starkly divided between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. The cause is celebrated, often in overt religious forms, as a manifestation of divine or historical will. All is dedicated to promoting and glorifying the myth, the nation, the cause. War is not always waged with guns and tanks and bombs. The soul is also a battlefield. When what we value, art, literature, music, film, the Gospels, Sunday school, is manipulated, We are changed in response. We cope, of course, by becoming active collaborators with this invading force. Eager for some sense of direction, we enthusiastically gorge on fascism, communism, the unthinking, simplistic, prepackaged portions of distorted Christianity, and that most tempting of sweets, the invisible hand of the free market. The third and final way in which we are confronted religiously by modernity is in relation to our sense of justice. In her book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, journalist Barbara Ehrenreich follows up on her previous volume of undercover investigation and analysis of blue-collar life with a stirring piece on the culture of white-collar unemployment. In the following passage from the chapter, Networking with the Lord, Ehrenreich details how the Christian right's perverted view of justice has become a dominant force in our society. What we want from a career narrative is some moral thrust, some meaningful story we can tell our children. The old narrative was, I worked hard and therefore succeeded, or sometimes I screwed up and therefore failed. But a life of only intermittently rewarded effort, working hard only to be laid off, and then repeating the process until aging forecloses decent job offers, requires more strenuous forms of explanation. Either you look for the institutional forces shaping your life, or you attribute the unpredictable ups and downs of your career to an infinitely powerful, endlessly detail-oriented God. After a final blessing, I make my way across the room to a familiar face. It's Ken, the quiet guy from Patrick Knoll's career boot camp, and he sort of recognizes me too. How's the search going? Ken says he's got a job, and he's starting Monday. So why is he here? To thank some people, say goodbye. I tell him I kind of resent all the religion at this event. It's fine with me, he says. I'm religious myself. So where will you be working, I ask. At my old place, where I got laid off a year ago. How do you feel about going back there? I mean, after they laid you off. Oh, no problem, he smiles beatifically. They didn't need so many people then, and now they do. So this is the new, ideal, right-wing, Christianized employee. Just in time, disposable when temporarily unneeded, and always willing to return with a smile no matter what hardships have been endured in the off periods. Maybe one of the functions of the evangelical revival sweeping America is to reconcile people to an increasingly unreliable work world. You take what you can get and praise the Lord for sending it along. Responding religiously and authentically to these challenges is not easy. Unfortunately, this is not a faith of many answers, and as we all know, no easy ones, and I take pride in that. I cannot offer you three simple steps that you can take over the course of the week, which will miraculously lift the burden and pain of living in this hurtling, hurtful world from off your back. To do so would simply be a method of coping. We can respond, however, and we must do so religiously. We must make our congregations sources of the three things which are so diseased in our larger society: a sense of the value of time, genuine identity, and justice. Ehrenreich points out that too often houses of worship simply reconcile people to an unjust world and an unjust fate. But we also have examples of quite the opposite. The civil rights movement, the abolitionist movement, the pro-choice movement, and the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered rights movements all had some base in religious communities who refused to accustom people to the world, but rather gave them the strength and the faith to rail against it. Our communities must become points of authenticity in a disingenuous world, sites of opposition and determination. Shore points out a number of ways to alter the systematic devaluation of meaningful uses of time. The demand for a shortened work week, which empirical studies have actually shown raises productivity, guaranteed minimum vacation time, as well as maternal and paternal leave. We can, of course, lobby for these moral issues as religious people. We can also, however, refuse to give in to the sense of hurry and good use which surrounds the commodity of time. We can give greater emphasis to the development of a Unitarian calendar of saints, cycles of daily prayer and meditation, which give a measured rhythm and greater meaning to the passage of our days. Prayer and meditation, in turn, reinvigorates our identity, and our opposition to unjust systems and practices. We can, as individuals, as communities, and as a movement, support and spread the good news about art, literature, and film, which speaks to the authentic human experience. We can confront the institutions which rob us of our dignity and our sense of purpose, inhumane corporate structures which place profits before people, and ideologies which doubt the value of human life at all. In essence, by battling modernity, we assert our autonomy. We carve a space for ourselves in the world, unbelittled by forces which seek domination and power over us. We lay claim to the sense of meaning and the sense of self, which modernity so desperately seeks to disrupt. And we pass on the good news to others.